signs that Jesus did, recorded by John, showing the glory of the Father. You'll find this particular sign, the great draught of fishes, or the, as we've put it, fish forgiveness in the future, in chapter 21 and verses 1 through to 14. Well, let's set the scene again for what happened in that great miracle. It's good perhaps to go back and think of the first sign that Jesus did. Some of the scholars combine two of the signs and say that each sign has a matching sign. I haven't done that as I've gone through, because sometimes that can get a little bit plastic and a little bit restrictive. But there is a similarity between the first and the last. You remember the first sign that Jesus did in Cana at the wedding showed the glory of the Father's provision in the person of his Son, the Messiah. So at the outset, God is saying, wherever my Son goes, there is a radical newness and a freedom and a vitality that is just absent in Israel. So in the place of corrupted religion, the new wine of God's kingdom would be freely and prodigiously given. So that was the kind of sign that the disciples saw or could have seen in that first, the wedding at Cana. The powerful love and joy of the kingdom would replace what had become heartless duty and form. Jesus was not on about just a perpetuation of what had been with a little bit of a tissy up. It had to be totally new. This love produced joy was and is the basis of what truly glorifies God. It's a theme, I think, throughout all of the signs. Just the simple joy that comes in seeing what happens when the king is about, what happens in the kingdom, in other words. The final sign in John showed the glory of Christ's ongoing provision, apart from which his disciples would toil in vain. It seems to me that's the central thrust of this sign. He'd said to them, you remember, when he was talking about the analogy between he and the, he being the vine and they being the branches, and he said, apart from me you can do nothing. That was not just a good spiritual statement that may or may not really have legs in life. It was absolutely the truth. Apart from me, there is nothing about the kingdom that you can do. We see later in Acts that not only did they understand that, and probably through this sign that we're looking at tonight, but they understood that it wasn't just that Jesus was going to give them strength to do things, but that he was going to be there doing them. And they were going to be participators, but mainly onlookers about the kingdom action. So the background verse, if we want to have one, that would take us to the thrust of tonight's sign would be, apart from me you can do nothing. So these two signs, the first and the last, form bookends of God's glory, his provision of joy and sustenance, joy at the wedding, and now tonight we're looking at the sustenance that he gives to them in a very simple and yet beautiful familial way. And it's that joy and that sustenance that would glorify his Father and himself forever. The provision of that and the outworking of that. From Cana forward, Israel on the whole hardened itself in the presence of these signs of glory. Remember, we've said that with every sign there was the opportunity to read it and to enter into it, to receive it, or there was the opportunity to reject it, and then that meant keeping on living how you'd been. In other words, there was a revelation of the truth, but you would say, no, that's not how I think it should be, which then meant that you went on living how you were, which was living apart from the truth, which in itself is a strong judgment. So with each sign done, there was a mounting judgment upon the nation and its leaders. It's interesting that this sign, we've chosen to call it a sign, some scholars don't, this was just done for the disciples. It's a very personal, intimate moment, really, as we'll see as we go on. Not to receive the signs, that is, read them, understand and be transformed by them, was to stay within the dead things of failed Judaism. Worse than that, it meant to be cut off from the only source of life and resurrection to life that God had always planned for his ancient people in the Messiah. You remember, the prophets had said, Israel is like a valley full of dry bones, and the only way out of that is resurrection. So the resurrection of Jesus is not just a sign of God's power to raise somebody from the dead. It is a parable to Israel saying, this is where you have to go to. And a sign to the whole world in the same way, because we were all dead in our sins. Now, thinking about the exchange way back with Nicodemus, for Israel to reject the divine, you must be born again, was to reject the only way back from being dead in sin to the glorious life of God. But the imperative, you must be born again, was not followed by what Israel thought it would be followed by, that is, by another approach to law-keeping. The must was only possible by the sovereign grace of the gift of regeneration present through Christ. So Christ becomes the focal point of the glory of God. He becomes the imperative, you must be born again. But he also becomes the means by which that happens and comes to us as a gift. After the raising of Lazarus, the leaders directly plotted to kill Jesus. It wasn't just an idea that crossed their mind occasionally. They set out intently to do it. The Sanhedrin plotted it. The events of his entry into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, the Last Supper, his consequent betrayal, arrest, trial, crucifixion and resurrection had been an incredible roller coaster for the disciples. Now, not to mention our Lord himself, of course, was most strenuous for him, but our focus for tonight really is upon the disciples and where they were at as they met with Jesus on the beach, and there's good indication that they needed some repair. And if we add to this, or to that roller coaster experience of their emotions over the last weeks, Peter's betrayal and their own offence and flight from the crucifixion scene, then they were all in need of pastoral repair. Not to mention, of course, the state of confusion. They had recognised that Jesus had been raised from the dead, but the whole ramification of that hadn't dawned on them. The significance of the Lord's resurrection hadn't dawned in all its glory. They'd been filled with joy at having the Lord back, but the universal ramifications of that joy going to the nations in the gospel under his lordship was still absent from their thinking. And I think that's brought out in what we look at next. It is debated, but we're going to explore a little way. Peter's great cry, I'm going fishing, has probably been a sermon heading for many, many sermons over the years. Whether his cry, which was endorsed by the others, we often forget that, I think. We think, oh, well, this was just Peter giving up and, you know, having one of his flip-flops. But the rest of them said, no, we're coming too. They'd gone back to their home area. Whether that represents the disciples reverting back to their old ways or something far less dramatic has been much debated. The Lord did actually tell them to go back to Galilee and he'd meet them there. But there does seem to be something in the way that he meets them there and what he finds them doing and the words that John describes what he finds them doing and not being able to do, that indicates that there was an attitude here of aimlessness and fruitlessness. The miracle that followed does expose an aimless fruitlessness among the inner group of disciples. Jesus had indicated before his death that the disciples would be scattered and return to their own homes. You can pick that up in chapter 16, verse 32. That prophecy, alongside the re-establishment of Peter as preacher, teacher, and pastor rather than Peter the fisherman, after this miracle, suggests that going fishing was an alternative to the work of Christ's kingdom. Now, we just suggest that, and we'll look at that, open that up a little bit in the next few minutes. It's true, is it, that we may all return quickly to familiar ground whenever we're confronted by things that deeply shake our world. There's nothing wrong with that, is there? In other words, something drastic happens in our experience and we look for some familiar ground in which we can hold on and say, well, I'll just rest here a while until I get my breath. So nothing really wrong with that, provided it doesn't become a hiding place and an alternative. It's possible to hide from our calling among the things that we feel comfortable doing or in which we feel some illusion of control. Maybe that's just me. Maybe it's not, but maybe it is. If it is, well, that's a confession in front of you. But there is an offence, isn't there, in being out of our depth, or that feeling that comes when we're out of our depth, or we feel out of control, or we feel that what we're doing is beyond us or whatever. And if we're not careful in those kind of scenes, that the flesh says, let's go and do something that you can actually control. As I said last week, or it might have been Sunday, I can't remember, many men have a shed for that reason. And it's interesting, isn't it, how, have you ever seen that book on men's sheds or men in their sheds? Some of them are actual shrines. They're turned into shrines. Everything that opens and shuts, it's their own little world. Sad, really. I mean, it's good to have a shed and it's good to have tools to do things, but when it becomes the place we escape to, maybe not. So just how much we want to say to Peter, come on, Peter, you're just doing one of your things, I'm going fishing, you're giving up on the Lord. We need to be careful how far we go there, but I think we can see in ourselves that perhaps we've gone fishing on occasions. And then the Lord's had to come find us fishing. So Christ comes fishing for men. It's really what's happening as he meets them on the beach. John is, as always, very poignant in the use of his words. And he says in verse 3, they'd caught nothing. Now, they'd been out all night, so they'd given it a fair go. These poignant words of John lead us to the action of the Lord's provision. In other words, against the fact that they'd laboured all night for nothing, suddenly their whole world is going to be confronted with fish and they didn't do anything except pull them in. We don't know whether they experienced deja vu. You remember there'd been an instance before when they'd fished all night and Jesus said, go out again and cast on the other side. You'll find that in Luke 5. You'd have probably thought towards the end of this account that the pennies would have been dropping again, but it's not recorded. John doesn't say, oh, well, that reminded me of another occasion. But, however, in the mercy of God, they were fishless after toiling all night with their nets. This seemed both a judgment and a mercy. If you fished all night in the cold, It does feel a bit of a judgment. Not that I've done that, but I fish late sometimes into the night, and the colder and darker it gets and the more fishless that you become, if that's not a contradiction, it seems like a judgment. And you think, well, I could have been home preparing my sermon. But it was also a mercy. Were the strivings of our flesh able to produce kingdom love, life and joy, then we would never submit to grace. That's just the truth of it. As incorrigible fishermen, we would move from one achievement to the next with the pride of religious satisfaction growing at a pace. The failure of the disciples at the things they felt most confident doing went to highlight the utter dependence of humanity upon the miracle that followed. Humanity since the garden has struggled violently, inwardly and outwardly, at dependence. It's a dirty word in our culture, and in most cultures, to have to depend on somebody else is a disparaging kind of, it seems to be a disparaging kind of thing. It seems to lead to a control that is not good. But the truth is, as Jesus said, apart from him, we can do nothing. So Jesus said to them, children or lads or boys, it was a kind of endearing term, you don't have any fish, do you? Now, I didn't know how to read that. You can read it kind of cynically, can't you? You don't have any fish, do you? Or you can just read it, and I think Jesus wasn't into cynicism, so it wouldn't have been cynical. There may have been a tongue-in-cheek and a bit of a grin. I don't know. You work it out how you think Jesus would have said that. But they just said no. Remember, at this stage, they didn't know it was Jesus. The Lord addressed the disciples in familiar terms, lads. His words were not cynical, rubbing their noses in their failure. God doesn't do that. Our guilty conscience will do that. It'll rub our noses in our failure as long as we let it. And it'll hold us there with our nose in our failure and all we see is our failure. But God is different to that. And that comes out in this exchange. So he wasn't rubbing their noses in their failure, but it was just a direct question so that their fruitless night could be clearly confessed or acknowledged. That's how God is. Doesn't get into game playing, spells it out so that the opportunity is there for us to say, yes, that is true. And may our confession be as simple as his word to us. It's when his simple word, say in this instance, is met with the weather wasn't too good and we'd stayed out a bit longer, we could have got some, I'm sure. They just said, no, we didn't get any. We're fishless. Despite not knowing who was telling them to put the net on the other or on the right side of the boat, the disciples obeyed, which is quite amazing, really. You would suspect that by that stage, tempers would be a bit short. And a stranger, have you ever been on the jetty fishing and you haven't caught something and somebody comes up and says, oh, I was here the other day, just go out a bit that way, you'll get some. And you say to yourself, who are you? Well, I don't know whether Peter and the others felt that way, but I reckon the recipe was there for it. But they did it, and the miracle was immediate. 153 big fish. So, then it starts. Things open up. John says it's the Lord. So, true to character, John is the one that sees things quickly. Peter's the one that jumps in quickly. Same thing happens. John says it's the Lord. Peter's hearing that it's the Lord. Puts something on, but he's probably naked, or down to a whatever they wore underneath, but not much, and threw himself into the sea. John immediately recognised that the one who commanded them was the Lord. In usual form, Peter was the one who exuberantly threw himself into the water and went to Jesus. There was a beautiful and godly passion in Peter to always be drawn to the Lord, who was the centre of his need. That's part of the contradiction of Peter and the flaw in Peter and the goodness in Peter, or the good response to Christ in Peter. At least he seemed to know where his needs could be met. Like many great saints to follow, Peter's flaws in no way impeded the expression of the Lord's love for him and through him. St. Augustine, or we just call him Brother Augustine, I guess, said, "Who is not aghast at the sudden crevasses that might open up in the life of a dedicated man?" All of the great men and women of history have been flawed people. It's become common to elevate the faith and goodness of God's saints into hero status. This takes them beyond us and subtly seems to provide an excuse for us never to be like them. In other words, if I can elevate Peter or anybody else to the status of a hero, inwardly I'm saying to myself, well, I'll never be a hero, so it doesn't really matter if I don't do what Peter does or Paul or whatever. So we revert to being impressed and interpret that is our impression, as motivation, whilst missing entirely what their lives were, that their lives were for the glorification of God's grace, not to impress another sinner. I'm not going to stop there and dwell, but it would be good to think about that, those last few sentences, as you take the notes home later. It's possible to smirk at Peter's impulsiveness in a kind of relieved way that somehow sees him like us, whilst missing the testimony of God through him. So when they got out on the land, John says, they saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish placed on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you've now caught," in verse 9. Several things stand out here. It's a very beautiful scene. May not strike us as that, although it may have as we've read it. The miracle of the great catch seemed to join seamlessly into the whole scene, which, if you think about it, has been a pattern of all of the signs. Sure, there was something incredibly dramatic that happened, and yet it seemed just to happen without a great hullabaloo, without a great put-on. So the signs that Jesus will do and has done are not just to be there to gain effect or to make a kind of big statement. They are there to be looked through and to be seen for what they are. Jesus made no further mention of it, that is, of the multiplication of the fish or the great catch, presumably because it spoke for itself and achieved his desired response in the disciples. They must trust that the risen Lord was indeed Lord and was with them for their sustaining and their joy. That seems to me to be what he's saying. The scene they met on the beach was a simple but loving service. Here was the Lord ministering to their needs with premeditated grace and purpose. They were a pretty disjointed bunch. They'd gone back fishing, and there was a group of seven of them. We're not told where the rest were. But they come through enormous pressure. And Jesus, thinking through where they were and aware of what drives a human heart in fear, premeditated this whole scene and went and prepared this meal for them. Here was the Lord ministering to their needs. He had said that he was amongst them as one who served, back in chapter 13. The resurrection hadn't changed that. His lordship, his elevation to the lordship of the universe hadn't changed that. Humanity was to have a Lord whose heart was to serve them. So different, isn't it, to our idea of lordship. Here was the unknown glory, hidden for decades, hundreds of years, of how the Father had always been, and now it was shining through again clearly in his Son. God is the greatest servant there has ever been. The relationship between the disciples and the risen Lord was familial and fitted without grating into the simplicity of table fellowship. That's what you figure, don't you, as you read through this little story. Here's the resurrected Lord of glory. And he sits with them alongside of a fire on the Sea of Galilee's shores. And nothing seemed out of place. No reprimand or criticism was meted out. He knew that as the Holy Spirit flooded them at Pentecost, the enormity of the love and mercy of the cross and resurrection and ascension would constrain their hearts to love for eternity. My Father is, remember his cry? My Father is working. And he was working there in these disciples. He was showing them his serving heart. And Jesus trusted that that would continue and come to full bloom at Pentecost. This, just another facet of this meal, it was a grace meal in which those who had been so confused and weak were greeted as true brothers and served as if they had been perfectly true to him through the crisis. Is that not how God disarms us? We go to others and wear their attentions. We make it clear that we want an apology before there'll be any kind of sitting down and eating together. Jesus seems to work the other way. And the grace of his presence is extended just as if they'd never sinned against him. He could have demolished Peter. True? Could have demolished a lot of them. Said, where were you when I needed you the most? That's all he would have had to say. Perhaps all he would have had to do would have been to look at them in a certain way. Instead, he makes a meal for them, greets them as true brothers. However, there does seem to be a strange reserve amongst the disciples as they come ashore. You pick it up in verse 12 and 13. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. And then John records it this way. There's a funny kind of awkwardness or something's going on. None of the disciples ventured to question him, who are you? Because they knew that it was the Lord. It's a funny way of putting things, isn't it? Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them and the fish likewise. So here were men quietly in awe, coming to grips with what the resurrection meant. No longer could they simply know Jesus according to the flesh. He still was flesh and blood, but things were really different. Here was one who was like no other, yet was with them in more than just a token way. These were great things they were having to come to grips with. Leslie Newbegin, a good old commentator, or a good commentator from a long way back, said this: in awe-struck silence they eat. They dare not ask, who are you? For the answer could only be, I am, or I'm God. So they eat what the Lord gives them, and the sharing of the meal is the unveiling of his presence. And John says this is the third time that Jesus manifested himself to us since he was raised from the dead. The word manifest, just on passing, it's more than just he was there and appeared. It is an unveiling, a self-disclosure. His presence, just to pick up another aspect of that little group on the shore, his presence was honouring and inclusive. He invited them to bring some of the fish that they'd caught. This cannot be construed as Jesus saying that by their labour they had brought their part into the equation of kingdom ministry, because the fish that they caught were provided by him. So it wasn't a your part and God's part, but he did include them and their labour in his action. A principle that they acknowledged after Pentecost in Acts chapter 4. They said in prayer, you remember, when they were under great pressure, "Now, Lord, take note of their threats and grant that your bondservants may speak your word with all confidence, while you extend your hand to heal, and signs and wonders take place through the name of your holy servant, Jesus." So there was their understanding that Jesus was the true minister and they were going to be there with him. They could speak, but he was the one who did the wonders and the signs of kingdom ministry. That verse, by the way, is a good indicator that we mustn't think that the signs and wonders that John has been leading us through stopped at the end of John. At the last great catch of fish, Jesus prophesied that Peter would become a fisher of men. Remember back the one that we just talked about earlier, the deja vu one? At that instance, Jesus had said to Peter, "You're going to become a fisher of men." Peter's reinstatement and commissioning as pastor caught up that promise. In other words, you can't be a pastor without being a fisher of men. It was likely that the miraculous catch of fish would be a reminder to Peter during his ministry that men could and would only ever be correctly caught by the Lord. He could toil all night, or as many nights as he wanted to, but it's really just Jesus who can actually catch a human being. We might trap them, we might manipulate human beings with a various array of psychological techniques, but it's only Jesus who can change their hearts to love the Father. That's what was happening in their hearts, so he knew that was true. Well, just come to the conclusion. Signs are for seeing. Our study title, Signs of Glory, could be falsely seen to imply that the presence of Jesus left mysterious clues as to his true nature and purpose, clues only accessible by clever spiritualists with cryptic skills. But each sign had a prodigality about it, a prodigiousness about it, that simple hearts open to faith found irresistible. To relegate these signs to history and examine them as curios is to misread them all. The lust to do this may well come from the desire to try to control the revelation of God's glory, thus keeping the lid, or trying to keep the lid on God in a domestic kind of way. I think what we grapple with is what the disciples grappled with around that breakfast of fish and bread. We know when we're in the presence of the Lord that we're not in a comfort zone. We know that's where we want to be, but we know that to be there is to be in the presence of one so great and mighty that we just cannot be casual or indifferent. So there's a kind of tension there. It's the place of true delight, and yet it's the place of true fear and awe. I think often we don't like to be in that position, and we like to do things in the church where it's all nice and kind of cozy and kind of controlled. And we put the excuse over all of that, that things in the church have to be done in an orderly way. Well, that's true. Jesus did all of these great signs in an orderly way. He made no great hubbub and he didn't go about it in a kind of provocative way. But nevertheless, something was going on there in each of these scenes that if we'd been a human observer and open to what was happening, our hearts would not have been able to get a full grip on it. I'd like to talk about that. I haven't got any questions for tonight, but there may be others that come up. To demand, on the other hand, that the Lord repeat these signs as a proof of his lordship today would also indicate a failure to read the signs John recorded for us. It would be to go back and to ignore what is written and say, do something special for me. The passage from Acts chapter 4, the one I've quoted above, seems to reveal the heart we should have. The church trusted that the risen Lord still extended his hand in signs and wonders as they proclaimed his word in confidence. There's not a division between those two. These days, in many situations, the preaching of the word in the power of the Spirit is relegated to a very small part, if any, in church service, some church services, and everything is given over to what we could say the presentation of signs and wonders. It's not how Jesus worked. As in the days of John, the signs Jesus does will never guarantee automatic faith. They may be rejected. Then the judgment of not seeing the fullness of all that the Father has given us in Christ will be upon our every thought. Sufficient to say, after our brief studies, the Father and his Lord, revealed in the signs of glory, transport dead hearts into a kingdom of breathtaking beauty and life. Don't be afraid, Jesus said, you remember? Little flock, for your Father has chosen gladly to give you the kingdom.